Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
In Central Florida, immigration enforcement has become more visible, and for many families, more frightening. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, January 22nd, 2026. Coming up, you will hear from supporters of stepped-up enforcement and one of the agencies partnering with Immigration and Customs Enforcement here. This week, Congressman Maxwell Frost and local immigration advocates condemned a possible new ICE facility in the region. Representative Frost confirmed that ICE officials were in East Orange County, touring a warehouse as a potential site for a new processing detention center.
We've received multiple reports of heavy ICE activity in different parts of Central Florida, including the University of Central Florida, Winter Garden, Altamont Springs, and other surrounding areas. We've also received reports of heavy ICE activity at certain hotels in the area as well. ICE is in the community, and that they have made pretty large hotel reservations in surrounding hotels as well.
He was joined by leaders from Hope Community Center who say there is increased ICE activity in Central Florida and a dramatic rise in the number of people being put on ICE holds at the Orange County Jail. The center is receiving dozens of concerned calls every day. Members of the Central Florida community helping those navigate heightened fear and uncertainty are uniting.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
Dozens of people met outside Orlando City Hall over the weekend to pray for immigrants.
We gather for every person, regardless of citizenship status, who fears for their family and their lives this day.
Participants circle around a microphone and at times hold hands. The organizers made it clear that this is not a rally or a protest. It's an interfaith prayer vigil for immigration justice.
My name is Rachel Siegel. I am the social justice organizer for the state of Florida. I'm based out of Central Florida, Orlando. This is a vigil that we conceptualized as a way to bring a moral and spiritual voice into this conversation. We thought it would help bring the people who may not see the same perspective as we do by using religious approach to it.
With the immigration enforcement, what are you seeing happening? What kind of impacts are you seeing in your community?
What I've seen is that people are so unbelievably scared. They are paralyzed with fear. And I think that in the last 2 weeks, that fear, that paralyzation has turned into action.
So I was out talking to people in the community pretty much all day yesterday, and almost uniformly, people were outraged by what they are seeing. When I, you know, held up something that said, let's get ICE out of Orlando, people were, you know, hell yeah, I agree with you. But the gap, I think, for a lot of people is in the like, okay, well, what are we going to really do about it?
That's Corey Hill with Orlando 50501, a local chapter of a national social justice movement. They helped organize a rapid response ICE watch training in Orlando last week that drew more than 300 people. Hill says the goal was to keep people safe by training volunteers to observe ICE activity and help families and legal teams get information when someone is detained. Organizers are holding the prayer vigils twice a month. But depending on who you're talking to, people view the stepped-up immigration reform differently. Kissimmee resident George Jacko is the former chair of the Osceola County Republican Party, and he supports ICE's role in immigration enforcement that he says is targeting criminals.
The full force of the law will be placed upon your shoulders, and you're going to go back to the country of origin.
Who should ICE be prioritizing?
Well, I think they are prioritizing those individuals that came here illegally, that were released from jails, that were incarcerated in other municipalities, states, or countries. And they should pursue what they are legally bound to do, and that is to enforce the law of the land. So the rapists, the sexual traffickers, the murderers, so on, individuals that were guilty of felonies in other countries. And I heard the number that during the Biden's administration, there were over 100 different countries where these individuals were coming over illegally. The border was open, although Biden and his administration says the border was secure. And that was a lie, a fabricated lie.
We have heard from families who say that they're afraid to go to work, to go to school, even leave their homes. So how do you weigh that fear against enforcement goals?
If they're guilty of coming here illegally, they don't belong here. There's a proper procedure. And ICE is following the procedures. You know, you're illegal, out. Period.
What about people who feel nervous because of the way they look, because of the color of their skin, that they're getting profiled?
Well, that's another thing. I've heard individuals say, well, they're racist and everything else. They're Nazis, fascists, and everything else coming in. And they're judging us or based on the color of the skin, be it brown, black, you name it. And I don't think that's true. I really don't.
Let me ask you what you would say to the people who see these images and argue that ICE is the instigator, ICE is the one being violent.
Well, you have to have individuals that are antagonizing. I've seen things on TV, and I've talked to a couple of individuals that were former ICE agents and Border Patrol members, and they indicated that we're peaceful people, okay? We don't antagonize. We don't retaliate. We don't initiate the action, okay? We follow through on what we are required and obligated to do under the law. You know, some people are complaining, well, they're masked individuals. And like I said previously, classifying them as Nazis, okay, as fascists, so on and so forth.
So, George, some people have expressed concerns about the impact on the economy that the immigration reform and enforcement could have. Do you have any concerns with that specifically?
I'm concerned about these individuals that come over here illegally and are hired by companies, be it a small company or corporations, and they're trying to save money by, you know, maybe paying them under the table for doing work that American citizens should have an advantage and have that opportunity to earn a good living here. Not an illegal immigrant. And it really gets me because some of these individuals call these illegal immigrants as undocumented. Sure, they're undocumented. They came here illegally. Call them what they are.
What is the takeaway, getting back to ICE and immigration enforcement? What do you want listeners to understand about why you support this approach?
Well, if they understand what their job description tells them, what they can do. And if the people don't understand what their job description is and why they're there, why this division was created, it is to protect this country, okay? Not to have open borders, okay? We have a process and procedure to follow. Follow it. So at this point, I get frustrated. Yeah, I was born here in the United States. My parents were born here in the United States. My grandparents on both sides were from Europe, and they came to this great country, and they knew what they had to sacrifice, but the sacrifice was well worth it in coming here. I wish people would truly understand what the function is of ICE and the Border Patrols. They have a job to do and follow through on a job, okay? They shouldn't have these individuals bursting into churches, okay? And, you know, ICE out, interfering in us of worship, then throwing bricks, standing in front of your vehicles, impeding your ability to have the ICE officers go to whatever institution that they're obligated to go to. That's part of their job.
Moving from Osceola County resident George Jacko explaining his support for ICE actions to the local law enforcement agencies on the ground. Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd says about 140 people are being held in the county jail on ICE detainers with accompanying criminal charges. I asked him whether he's seen an increase in ICE enforcement actions recently.
The best way to describe this is there's a lot of angst and white noise around this process. We at the Sheriff's Office are not doing anything different today than we did in the Biden administration, the last Trump administration, and the Obama administration.
He says what's different now is that the federal government added hundreds of thousands of deportation warrants or detainers to a national law enforcement database that local agencies use during traffic stops and arrests. That addition means deputies are more likely to know that someone is flagged by ICE. Sheriff Judd talks about how their cooperation works.
Here's what we do. Anytime we interact with someone, we run a warrants check. That is no different than we've done for the decades that I've been employed at the sheriff's office. So if we stop a vehicle on the side of the road, we do a warrants check. We're looking to see if the people in that vehicle, in addition to their instant reason for a stop, also have other charges. Frequently they do. The difference is now ICE has a 1.5 million more warrants in the file. So we're bumping into more people. Our folks are simply doing the same exact job they've always been doing. So there's no special emphasis because of illegal immigration. The illegal immigrant with a removal has always been there. Or they have accumulated over time. The difference is we're seeing these people when we do the same check that we've always done.
We've seen a number of community trainings pop up where residents are learning how to identify ICE activity and alert others. How do you view those?
I view that as an interference and a violation of law.
What would you say to the families who say they're afraid to leave their homes? Do you see that fear as a problem?
Are those folks here illegally?
There are concerns from people who are and concerns from people who are here legally and American citizens.
What I would say to the folks that are here illegally and are concerned about leaving their home, you assume that risk when you came into this country in violation of the law. So I don't know what to tell you. If I go into Germany or Italy or France or any other country illegally, I assume the risk of being detained, put out of the country, arrested. So the reality is we've got to understand that it is important to see the vision here. The vision is they came here in violation of our law. Now, we can have a whole different conversation about the quality of the law. Does the law need to be changed? I am a big proponent, and I truly believe from the bottom of my heart that the people that came here 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago illegally, while in violation of federal law, if they're not taking government money, if they're not committing crime, if they're working, taking care of their family, being productive, living what I call the American life, they should be given the opportunity. There should be a path because we need those folks in the United States. Quite frankly, I want those folks in the United States. And we need to be focusing on the worst first and those committing crime in the United States. Then we need to focus on those that have been given the opportunity of due process and the federal courts have said, no, you've got to go home, and you didn't. They've got to go.
When you said focus on the worst first, violent criminals, is that what you're seeing happening?
When I talk about the worst first, I don't just mean violent criminals, because I mean anyone that violates the law.
I want to make sure I get your answer to something. I just want to hop back to it for a second.
Okay.
What would you say to families in Central Florida who are scared, those who are here legally, but feel they are being targeted because of the color of their skin?
I can assure you that's not happening. I can also assure you that news media and social media are scaring those wonderful people. They're here legally, and they're not, absolutely, unequivocally, not being targeted because of the color of their skin. In fact, that is offensive to me as a professional law enforcement officer that would fire anyone that did that, that worked for me, immediately. It just is not happening in this shop, and I suggest to you and our law enforcement agencies across the state of Florida, that should never, ever, ever be happening.
and I'm not aware of it. We will not do that. That is offensive for anyone to suggest that we do that.
From the federal level, as there are more noticeable ICE agents, do you hear from people in your community, residents, either concerns about their presence or relief that they're there?
No, we're not seeing that. And the reason we're not is because we cooperate. We have a statewide meeting, Zoom meeting, a couple of times a month with state representatives, with ICE representatives, with local representatives to work out situations, concerns, problems, coordination. But the reason people are seeing this kind of conduct from ICE in Minnesota, in Los Angeles, California, is because those states have passed laws for sanctuary cities or sanctuary states. They prohibit local law enforcement from working with or telling ICE, hey, we've made an arrest on this guy and he's here in the country illegally. They can't even communicate that. In their jails, in their lockups, they won't allow ICE in there to do ICE checks for those that are in the country illegally. So ICE is sending a lot of infrastructure into those states to enforce the federal law. You're not seeing any of that in Florida. You know why? Because we report people to ICE and they tell us, yes, that person's in the country illegally. Yes, there's a warrant for their deportation. Yes, we want an ICE hold on them. And we do that. And then they come and pick them up or we deliver them to ICE within 48 hours.
You heard Sheriff Grady Judd mention what's happening in Minnesota. That's where Reverend Gabriel Salguero is today. He traveled from Orlando to Minneapolis to meet with evangelical leaders and respond to what he describes as indiscriminate immigration enforcement. He's calling for nonviolent, peaceful protest and the humane treatment of immigrants while supporting the detention and deportation of violent criminals. Reverend, I would actually love to start with your experience and you. Can you speak to what it means to talk about ICE, not just as a pastor or advocate, but as a Latino man?
Well, it's hard for me to separate those things because they all integrate my identity. And so I'm a pastor. I am a Latino man. My experience with ICE is varied. I know ICE officers who are members of churches in our coalition. And then I've also seen how this indiscriminate enforcement action has led to racial profiling and anxiety in our community. And so like with any profession, you get these mixed reactions and mixed interactions. And so for me, it's important that we don't paint every immigration officer the same way, even while we critique policies and practices that are raising anxiety in our community.
When there are reports of ICE in Central Florida, what do you hear from the immigrant families in your congregation and in the community?
What I hear from the members of our church and the members of our community is a heightened level of anxiety, deep concerns, even among citizens or permanent legal residents, that they will be racially profiled, that these indiscriminate enforcement actions will separate families. There's a lot of anxiety around the separation of families and what we do with our children if we are detained or deported, what we do with our businesses, what's the plan of action. And so I think the big word is anxiety. And I think the other reaction I hear a lot of is uncertainty. What is really going on here? What is the purpose of this? Many of them were told and believed that the target was violent criminal immigrants, which our community supports the detention and deportation of violent criminal immigrants, but that's not what we're seeing on the ground.
What does that anxiety and uncertainty mean for attendance at your church or for people in the community getting help or even those willing to leave their homes? Is any of that impacted?
The impacts are so many. For example, in many of the churches in our coalition, there's been a decrease in worship attendance, 30%, 40%. People are afraid to go to church. People are afraid to go shopping, drop their kids off or pick up their kids from school. And so that anxiety manifests in the day-to-day lives of the people we serve. Think about you trying to drop off your kid in elementary school or middle school or high school and being afraid that as soon as you drop him or her off, you'll be detained and deported. And your child doesn't know after school, they have no one to pick them up. Think about you wanting to go worship and sing songs with your children to church and have communion, but you're too afraid. So a lot of our churches have what we call compassion fatigue because we're shopping for these immigrants. We're picking up their children. There's a whole accompaniment ministry that the Latino Evangelical Church, which is, and the Haitian churches is doing. So there's a lot more work for us to do, even as we seek for this problem to be resolved.
What more work, what additional ways is the church stepping up to help people right now?
Well, first of all, we're doing advocacy for the administration and Secretary Noem to reconsider their position on removing sensitive locations as places of enforcement. We're doing advocacy for bipartisan immigration, humane immigration reform, and the reconsideration of indiscriminate enforcement actions, even as we support the detention and deportation of violent criminals. We're also doing accompaniment. Some of our people are going to hearings, immigration hearings, with our neighbors and our friends and members of our faith community. Because although many of them are complying with their hearings, they're being detained and deported right after their hearings. We're doing a Know Your Rights webinars and teachings. And so we're doing everything we can to come alongside these immigrants who are overwhelmingly good people, hardworking people, and members of our worshiping community and our larger community.
Listening to you talk, I'm wondering, what is your goal? What does success look like as a result of the actions that the church is taking right now?
Number one, a de-escalation in indiscriminate enforcement action. That racial profiling is not a part of this. That mothers and fathers and children are not targeted in this indiscriminate enforcement action, one. Number two, a rescinding of the executive orders that has removed churches, hospitals, and schools from sensitive locations. But in the long term, bipartisan immigration reform that's humane and common sense. Yes, we evangelicals support secure borders. Yes, we support the detention and deportation of violent criminals. But at the same time, we have to find a way forward for the millions of people been living here for years, raising their children here, going to church, going to university, some of them serving our country. I think what we're looking for is less heat and more light on immigration. And these indiscriminate enforcement actions are not bringing light. They're bringing heat, and they're certainly not bringing solutions. They're exacerbating tensions that I think we can find a third way forward that respects the rule of law, but treats immigrants humanely and with God-given dignity.
Do you have hope that can be achieved?
I'm a prisoner of hope. I'm a pastor. It's not lost on me that in recent days we celebrated the life of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The civil rights movement took over a decade to reform laws and to change both federal laws and state laws. And so I'm a prisoner of hope. The anti-apartheid movement with Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu took decades. And for the Latino Evangelical Church, this might be our Selma. What's happening in Minneapolis, what's happening in Los Angeles, what's happening in Chicago, and here in Florida, these operations, this increased enforcement, what Governor DeSantis has started this campaign since last year, this might be our Selma, where we're saying we can and we must do better. People of goodwill, people of faith, people of moral conscience, they can see with their own eyes that these indiscriminate enforcement actions are not solving the problem. They're not doing what we were told, which is focusing on violent criminals. And certainly, it's not leading to bipartisan, humane, common sense immigration reform. So am I hopeful? If history teaches us anything, is that people of faith are resilient and that we will stick to it till things change.
How do you preach hope when people are afraid that their families are going to be torn apart?
We preach hope by presence. By telling them you are not alone. Every time an undocumented immigrant family is separated, the church will walk with them. We don't just preach hope, we practice hope by accompanying people to their immigration hearing, by helping them find immigration lawyers, by advocating in the state legislature against Operation Tidal Wave and in the federal law for common sense, humane immigration reform. You see, we are not just proclaimers of hope, we're practitioners of hope. What we tell every single immigrant that walks into our community is we will walk with you till the tide is turned. The thing that people are missing is that a lot of people talk about the numbers, but they don't talk about the stories. It's not just 1,000 people. These people have names and families and histories and children. So it's not just about the numbers. It's about the stories and the lives of the people we are serving. Immigration is not just a policy debate. It's a real life debate that has real life consequences and repercussions for families and children. And so every time we talk about immigration, we should talk about the immigrants that we seek to serve. I really believe that the church can be that trusted broker to find a way forward. There are 10 million Latino evangelicals in this country, not to mention Haitian and West Indian and African, who want to find the way forward between the rule of law and respect for the dignity of citizens and immigrants.
Orlando Reverend Gabriel Salguero is president of the National Latino Evangelical Coalition. And we asked you to weigh in. I'll share part of what Eduardo emailed us, questioning who is actually benefiting from the ICE enforcement. He wrote, "ICE is arguably an important department of the government. Therefore, it is an institutional paper. It is the agents, cowardly hiding their faces and identity, who actually generate the violence because they enjoy total impunity and immunity. The most important questions that need to be asked are about the unnecessary display of violence and cruelty. Where does this hateful aggression come from?" Thank you, Eduardo. And we appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org or send a talkback on the free Central Florida Public Media app to do the same. There's more ahead here on Engage. Missions to space don't just start at liftoff. We discuss the key tests happening this week on our space coast to send people back to the moon for the first time in decades. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Before anyone heads back to the moon, NASA has to pass critical tests on the ground on our space coast. The Artemis II mission took an important step this week. NASA's Space Launch System and Orion capsule made that slow trek to its launch pad at less than a mile an hour. The whole journey took more than 12 hours. The spacecraft is docked at Launch Pad 39B, where teams are getting ready for a dress rehearsal for a crewed launch to send people back to the moon for the first time since 1972. Joining us to break down what this moment really means is Brendan Byrne, Central Florida Public Media's assistant news director and host of the podcast Are We There Yet? That dives into the space industry. Brendan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Sharon.
So NASA has to get this craft to the launch pad pretty much now because there's a deadline looming, what, just a few days?
That's right. Well, if NASA is going to make a launch window that opens up February 6th, they have to do what's called a wet dress rehearsal by the end of this month. What a wet dress rehearsal is essentially a practice run of launch day, all the way up to just a few seconds before the thing would actually leave the planet. That includes waking up all of the people that are going to be launching it, getting them on their console, as they say, doing all the checkouts, making sure everything is right, and then they actually fuel the vehicle. The SLS rocket takes an incredibly large amount of super, super chilled cryogenic fuel, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So they're going to fuel the tanks up with that as well and run through. And then they go through the countdown all the way up to T-minus 29 seconds. Now, this is really important. They have to get through this before they can even think about going to a launch. Over the weekend, we heard from Charlie Blackwell Thompson. She is the launch director for NASA's Artemis II mission. Here's what she had to say about the wet dress rehearsal.
We need to get through wet dress. We need to see what lessons that we learn as a result of that. And that will ultimately lay out our path toward launch. With a wet dress that is without significant issues, if everything goes to plan, then certainly there are opportunities within February that could be achievable.
There are opportunities in early February, and there are also opportunities if they happen to miss those few dates at the start of the month. There are opportunities to launch Artemis in March and April.
Okay, so it sounds like this is really where the mission begins.
Mm-hmm.
Before Orion heads to the moon, NASA has to run, you know, checks and some early maneuverability testing. What are they looking for at this phase, and what do they need to see happen before they can keep going?
Yeah, so Artemis 2, you nailed it. It is a test mission for future missions to come, right? Eventually, NASA wants to land humans on the moon by Artemis 3 and beyond. They're talking about Artemis 4, 5, 6, 10, 20, Artemis 100. But in order to do that, they have to check out the Orion spacecraft. So when it does launch, whenever that day does come, it will launch into orbit and then go into a very, very high orbit of Earth. And they will check out all sorts of things on the vehicle, make sure it's working, including the life support system and its solar arrays that are going to power the vehicle. But then they're going to fly it. They're actually going to separate the capsule from the rocket engine, that the stage that got it up into that high Earth orbit, and we'll fly it around there to see how it maneuvers. And then if it's able to dock with a future lunar lander or lunar space station, after all those checkouts are done, they'll fire the engines one more time, and then they are on that trip to the moon and back again.
Okay, so assuming everything goes well, how soon could we see the next crewed mission?
To the moon, to the lunar surface?
Yeah.
If all goes well, we could see it as early as mid-2027. But it's not just Artemis 2, not this upcoming mission that has to go well. There are a few other things that are in development that are really important. Artemis 3 is going to put humans on the lunar surface. There are two critical pieces of hardware that you need to do that. You need something to get them from the lunar orbit, so a lunar lander, and you need something to protect them from the harsh environment on the lunar surface, their spacesuits. Both of those things are still under development, seeing some delays. Most publicly, we have seen the lander have some delays. That is a SpaceX Starship vehicle. You may have seen the videos online of Starship blowing up. Well, that has happened. And the development of Starship, which will be used as a lunar lander, has hit a few bumps in the road. It still has yet to reach orbit, and SpaceX needs to prove that. It needs to prove that it can transfer fuel between multiple Starships in orbit to fuel this lunar lander. So a lot of that still has to happen. But SpaceX is a very scrappy and resourceful company. They are making great progress on Starship. So there are things that have to happen on the ground as well as Artemis 2 in this kind of lunar flyby that have to work in order to get humans on the moon. So the earliest, NASA is saying, is mid-2027. That can certainly move to the right.
We're talking about a lot of testing, a lot of deadlines, a lot of moving pieces here. Are there any concerns that you're hearing about just how quickly this is all progressing?
It did seem to come at us pretty quick, didn't mm-hmm. it? There are certainly some forces that are propelling this mission forward. One being political. The Artemis program was announced under President Trump's first term. Artemis 1, the uncrewed mission, launched in 2020. And now, with President Trump's second term, they surely want to see some successes with this program here. I spoke with Don Platt. He is a professor over at Florida Tech. He also worked as an engineer helping build the International Space Station. And I asked him, does this seem like this is rushed? And here's what he had to say.
This Artemis 2 mission was sort of moved to what we call the left. And so when they move something to the left, that means kind of makes it happen quicker. Usually in space, we're used to schedules going out to the right or being delayed. And so I believe certainly the Trump administration sees that it's critically important the United States maintains leadership in space, especially with human involvement in space. And, you know, these kinds of very large and grand projects certainly kind of, I think, fit with visions that Donald Trump has of what the United States is supposed to be about.
The mission managers have come out and said they will not launch until they are ready. There is a group of people that are making sure all of these safety measures are in place so they don't get what's known as launch fever. You know, NASA has learned a lot from the disasters of Columbia and Challenger, which they apply to their culture here as well. So while there are political pressure points to get this moving, there are checks in place to make sure that a decision isn't made hastily or without the safety of the astronauts in mind.
So after talking to you, I can see just how important Artemis 2 is. Zooming out for a moment, looking at NASA's goals, in addition to getting to the moon again, does this have any bearing on getting people closer to Mars?
In the grand scheme of things, yes. you know, keep in mind, this is the first time we're going to the moon since 1972, right? Mm-hmm. The first time in more than 50 years. This is the first time we are putting humans in deep space since then as well. The moon is in deep space. This is an extremely harsh environment for not only spacecraft, but for spacefarers, right? For the people that are going there. So what we learn from Artemis about how the human body reacts to the radiation of deep space, we're no longer protected by Earth's Van Allen belts, that are going to apply that to missions to the moon. Communication is delayed when you're at the moon. It certainly is delayed when you're at Mars. We're going to learn different techniques as to how to deal with that delay and also how to deal with the psychology of these astronauts not being able to communicate with people. So we're going to be learning about that. They're testing some AI chatbots while they're there to have somebody, you know, talk to. So in the human space flight, the practicality of that is there. But also the long-term goal of the Artemis mission is to establish a science base at the lunar South Pole, which scientists are very sure there is water trapped under there. It is frozen and more like granite than a piece of ice. But they want to get to that because once you have access to water, you're able to do a lot of stuff when you're not close to home. You can use that for life support, right? You separate the atoms. You got hydrogen and oxygen. You can breathe that oxygen. But you can also use hydrogen and oxygen as fuel and oxidizer. So their plan is to turn the moon into a lunar gas station to fuel those missions that we go to Mars. So before, let's say you and I are taking a trip to Mars, we'll have to stop our spacecraft at the 7-Eleven on the moon, fuel up, and then head to Mars.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty wild, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And before you go, I have to ask you, and this is a reflection of me, not them, the astronauts who are stepping up for this mission. This all sounds kind of terrifying to me, overwhelming. Who are these braver astronauts who are signing
you
up
wouldn't
for?
You wouldn't go? You're not going to go?
I mean, I would rather wait.
Yeah, me too.
I'll go to the gas station on the moon with you, but I won't be the first.
Okay.
Yes.
So there are three NASA astronauts and one astronaut from the Canadian Space Agency. Reid Wiseman is the commander. Victor Glover is the pilot. Christina Cook is the mission specialist from the NASA side of things. And Jeremy Hansen is from the Canadian Space Agency. These are all astronauts who know what they're doing, have great training. Christina Cook, you may know that name. She participated in the first all-female spacewalk a few years ago. Victor Glover has been to the International Space Station, will be piloting the Orion spacecraft. These are trained people, and they've been training for a very long time, even before their selection. I had an opportunity to chat with Christina Cook before she was selected about those kind of things that they're training for, and it was really interesting. Like, when you get to the lunar South Pole, the shadows are so long because of where you are, so it's very, very dark. So they do a lot of their training in the dark because that is what they are going to have to do. They won't have light. So that's even more terrifying, right, Sharon?
Indeed.
But for them, you know, this is a critical step in what NASA is doing moving forward. And they even view this as a critical step in humanity, right? Going back to the moon to a place that we've never been there before. Christina Cook was asked about this on Saturday when she was watching her vehicle roll out to the pad. Here's what she had to say about the legacy of her and this mission.
What I see is the fact that all the people here on Earth, when they look up at the moon during our mission, before our mission, after our mission, during Artemis 3 and missions beyond, all the way to Artemis 100, they'll know that not only have we been there in the past, but we actively go there. We send people there because we're humans that must explore.
You know, so her and her crew, if all goes well, could be launching on that mission to the moon as early as February 6th.
Central Florida Public Media Assistant News Director and host of the podcast, Are We There Yet? Brendan Byrne, it's always a joy to talk to you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, meet the performers stepping into the spotlight from Orlando to the biggest global drag competition happening now. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. 17 years ago, a show debuted on Logo TV that completely changed the way America looked at drag queens. RuPaul's Drag Race. Start your engine. RuPaul's Drag Race. Be the best woman.
RuPaul Drag Race.
Start your engine.
RuPaul Drag Race.
Never best woman.
RuPaul's Drag Race took the art of drag out of gay bars and burlesque and into living rooms across the country. The show was hugely successful, catapulting an already famous RuPaul into A-list stardom. The show is currently in its 18th season, airing on MTV. Beyond the glamour and the drama the show is revered for, the Drag Race presented a world free of judgment or persecution, an environment where creativity and individuality were encouraged. For many young gay men, the show provided validity. For Orlando native Michael Reichert, RuPaul's Drag Race was a ticket out of the closet. Today, Michael is better known by his stage name, Mikey Meeks, an almost over-the-top drag queen who describes herself as stupidly glamorous and glamorously stupid. But beneath the wigs and the makeup is a trained actor with experience on the Shakespearean stage. Mikey Meeks joined Engage to talk about growing up queer in Orlando, being on the season of the Drag Race, and the first time he saw the show.
I remember flipping through channels and stumbling upon Logo TV, and I specifically remember seeing a queen named Jujubee. She was on the second season of RuPaul's Drag Race. And just that personality, the charisma, the humor, it was a type of personality I was not familiar with, but I still felt like, oh, that's me. Like, I see myself as that type of person. And then as they would air reruns or show the show more, I was watching it in secret. And then eventually I got hooked. So every year I was watching it by myself. And it wasn't until I got into college that I was able to talk about it with friends who were also watching it. It's actually how I came out to my best friends, because I was still in the closet freshman year of college. And they were watching the show, and I had to act like I didn't know what it was. And then eventually when I came out, I was like, I'm gay. Also, I'm obsessed with RuPaul's Drag Race, and it's been 10 years since.
Can you describe growing up queer in Central Florida? Like, you just mentioned that you were closeted until college. Was this a welcoming community for LGBTQ youth in the 2000s?
I think yes and no. I think there is still remnants of the Bush era type of don't ask, don't tell type of mindset. I think people around me could see it for myself. It's just I never wanted to prove anybody right with that. I still had to figure it out. I mean, hey, I went to a performing arts magnet high school. The people around me were already out. I just wasn't ready for myself to say so. I think that if I did come out in high school, it would have been very much accepted. I mean, I think people were expecting me to do that. It's a different time now. I started college before gay marriage was legalized. So it was still this type of, I almost say taboo, but it was a different era at that time. So I came out in 2015, right after gay marriage was legalized. As for the Central Florida community, I think there's pockets of people who are wildly accepting, very queer themselves. I just had to find those people.
So you have this background and training in musical theater and acting. You were with Orlando Shakes for a few seasons. I want to know, when did drag enter the picture for you as a performer?
I love that question. So yes, I went to the University of Central Florida and got my BFA in musical theater. And I very much had that mindset of you go to school for theater and you pursue it and go to New York and all of that. Right after college, I had started exploring in the nightlife scene, meeting more queer friends and finding this whole different passion, this different type of expression than just stage performance. And then I had left Orlando for 9 months to do an internship at Florida Repertory Theater down in Fort Myers. And although the internship was great and it did help my theater resume, it was burning me out of this love. And I think I started to realize I missed a whole other aspect of my life, which was this queer nightlife experience. And so to get my mind off of the grind of this internship, I started January 2019 of putting a look together, putting a drag look together and posting it. I knew I didn't look good, but just to say I'm starting and a year from now, I'm going to be happy that I did. And once I got back to town in Orlando, a good friend of mine, Galvin, offered me a performance gig because he saw that I was starting to pursue this. And now we've been business partners for 7 years now, and he's my manager. As soon as I got the call for Drag Race, he took that on, and it's been an amazing relationship.
How do you describe the Mikey Meeks brand to someone who has never seen you perform?
Well, I describe myself as a theatrical, dynamic powerhouse. Orlando has trained me to be very versatile. I do glamour, I can do camp, and I'm here to show that funny girls can be beautiful, okay? Theater is my upbringing and my training, but it doesn't necessarily show in my aesthetic. So I could really give any type of aesthetic that you want, but I do gravitate towards more old Hollywood glamour and party girl. So I like to say I'm a cross between Ava Gardner and Charlie XCX.
Something that's on my mind listening to you talk about being a performer, drag and trans communities have become politicized nationally and in Florida. As a performer, has that shaped the way you show up on stage or off?
Absolutely. I host a show at the Renaissance Theater Company called Off the Record. And as we continue each year, I realize how much younger our crowds are. We started off with the community that we had, and every year we're getting a whole new batch of 18 to 21-year-olds. And this is their first time experiencing nightlife and this queer community. And as the host of the show, I find it very important to remind everybody, yes, this is a fun space, but this is also a bubble. This is our community specifically. And we are entering this adulthood that you need to be aware of what's happening around you. I make it very clear that this is a safe space. This is where we can come together as a community. But there are people out there who don't want us to exist and also fear who we are as queer people. So we have to use our voices and come together to fight that type of negative opinion. During Ron DeSantis's tirade on drag back in 2022, 2023, I've had shows canceled because of him. We had a whole venue shut our show down because he threatened to take their liquor license away. It's just ridiculous. We are who they fear the most. And I like to make sure that my audiences are ready to use their voices and fight back no matter what comes our way.
I want to keep this a spoiler-free conversation. Can you describe, though, being selected to compete on this season's Drag Race?
It was one of the best moments I've ever experienced when I got the official casting call. This is my fourth time submitting for Drag Race. And the first two times, I had no expectations of it. I just submitted for the practice because that audition tape is ridiculously hard. But this fourth tape that I did, I felt it. I felt when I submitted, if I don't get this, I don't know what more I can show, because this was everything I got. And when I got the initial call of, hey, you're being considered, and then the final casting call, it was so validating. Not that I needed the validation, but it felt so good. I've been working in Orlando for 6 years now, and I feel like I have checked off everything I wanted to accomplish within the city. And I knew Drag Race was the next step to take me to a worldwide platform. And I knew I had something to show for it as well. So to have this opportunity to showcase Central Florida art on this national level, it just means the world to me.
Did anything about the experience surprise you? It's a reality competition. Did you find a sense of camaraderie, though, within the show?
You know, we are drag queens and more seasoned cast this year. So obviously there's some cattiness and there is some back and forth between the girls, but it's all in fun. I love these queens so much. We do have a group chat and we are talking every day. What I found the most interesting within the process to keep myself going was I had to fully accept and believe the compliments my peers have given me throughout the years. You know, I'm in an industry where people come up to you like, oh, you're so fun, so great and all that. And sometimes you shrug it off like that, you know, I've heard that. But to fully believe it, to know that these opinions are true and you have to accept that and use that power, is what helped me accomplish a lot of these challenges.
To the kids who are watching you now on RuPaul's Drag Race, the way that you did it years ago, what do you hope they take away from seeing you?
We spend a lot of time not liking ourselves. We spend a lot of time nitpicking our own qualities, but who we are as individuals, we each have a special power. And once you're tapped into it, you're unstoppable. I say hard work goes a long way. And if you have that dream or you have that goal, do what you need to make it happen. I worked my 9-to-5 on top of doing drag to make this a reality. And once I started seeing the fruits of my labor is when I found real joy in my life. There's obviously stressful days, but I am living my dream right now. And it is possible. It is possible. And also, if there's any kids out there who are just like me, who are watching the show and they're still in the closet, I say take your time, but know that there is a whole world and community ready to take you into their arms.
You can catch Mikey Meeks on the next episode of RuPaul's Drag Race tomorrow night at 8. That's all for today's edition of Engage. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. NPR News is next.